Hi, welcome to this week's program. Many times in my career, I have launched into detailed discussions of the economy, of interest rates, and how they affect bondholders. Often when I finish, someone will turn to me and ask, Steve, what is a bond? And that's when I realize that most people are just not that familiar with how bonds actually work. Well, if you're one of them, this commentary is for you. So, to begin, there are only two types of investments. Either you own something or you lend money. That's it. With stocks, you're an owner. With bonds, you're a lender. So remember, with bonds, you're lending money. Now, as a lender, you can expect two things. You expect your money back at some future date, and you can expect to receive a fair rate of interest during that period. The shorter the lending term, the lower the interest rate. The longer the term, the higher the rate. Now, the interest earned is often most a fixed percentage, 2%, 3%, 8%, whatever, but it's usually a fixed percentage. The rate of interest is determined not only by the length of the term, but by the ability of the borrower to pay you back and the level of interest rates in the general economy. The better the borrower's credit, the lower the rate of interest you'll receive. You know, like a credit card, you would expect to pay less if you had good credit and more if your credit was poor. Well, the lender feels the same way. As a bondholder, remember, you are the lender. Let's take it a step further. Imagine that you lent money to two of your friends. The first friend's loan was for 2 years and the rate was 2%, and the other was for 30 years at 5%. Let's imagine how you would feel if, in the following 6 months, interest rates in the general economy doubled for all new types of investments that were the same. In other words, 2% rose to 4% and 5% doubled to 10%. How disappointed would you be with the rates you originally charged? Well, with the 2-year loan, probably not so much because you're getting your money back shortly, and that will enable you to reinvest at higher rates. On the other hand, the 30-year loan would likely be a significant disappointment. The $10,000 you loaned, which is paying you $500 per year, that's 5%, could now pay you $1,000 per year, that's the 10%, if only you had known that rates were going to rise. Alas, it's too late because you are now committed to receiving $500 per year for 30 years. Ouch. Well, what if you said, hey, maybe I can just sell this loan, and let's call it a bond now. Maybe I can sell this bond to someone else and use that money to buy the new bond earning 10%. As good as that sounds, it wouldn't work because, frankly, who would buy your bond at 5% if they could get 10% elsewhere? Now, in the real world, and really this is just a simulated example, it's not the real world per se, your $10,000 bond would fall in price to $5,000, thereby allowing someone to buy two of your bonds to get their 10%. So what's the takeaway? If interest rates rise during your ownership of the bond price will fall. How much will it fall? Well, with the 2-year example, not so much, since you're getting your initial investment back quickly. The 30-year bond will drop considerably more to match the going rate. Now, just a note so bonds don't get a totally bad reputation. If interest rates do the opposite, if interest rates in the general economy fall, then bond prices will rise, so you can actually make money if interest rates go down. Now, keep in mind that the market value of your bond does not affect the interest you receive or the return of your original investment in the future. It only affects the money you would receive if you sold it. So to summarize, bonds are loans. The interest rate is based on the maturity of the bond. It's based on the credit of the borrower and the level of interest rates in the general economy. The risk? Well, your borrower's ability to pay you back and the situation in which you'll find yourself if the bond's maturity is long-term and rates rise in the meantime. Of course, there are numerous other factors and risks at play in the world of bonds, but this is a good start. So now that I've said something about bonds, I want to say something about stocks. Remember earlier I mentioned that there are only two types of investments. Either you own something or you lend money. For the purposes of this commentary, owning equals stocks and lending equals bonds. It's arguable, but in my opinion, most stock investors have no idea what they are actually investing in. Typically, they buy with the hope that their stock purchase will rise in value, but they have no understanding of what really drives the increase. Most investors, therefore, are really just gambling with their money and, most likely, also their financial future. So what is a stock? Investopedia says, a stock is a share in the ownership of a company, and stocks represent a claim on the company's assets and earnings. Let me repeat that. A claim on the company's assets and earnings. That's important. As a shareholder, you have a claim on assets like tangible property, like their real estate or their equipment, as well as intangible property like intellectual property, patents, and the like. Therefore, a claim on the earnings of the company in which you have a stock means you own all current and future net earnings, which, combined with the magic of compounding, may actually create large amounts of wealth. Here's an example. In 1972, an investor bought a company which had net earnings of $4.2 million. In 1987, 15 years later, the company's earnings had increased to $82 million. That's a 20 times increase. 9 years later, in 2007, when the investor added up all the earnings he had received to date, the amount came to a whopping $1.65 billion. How much did he pay 40 years earlier for this bounty? He paid only $25 million. He spent $25 million and received $1.65 billion in earnings over the course of 40 years. That is the incredible power of the claim on earnings. But what about the actual value of the stock after earnings had increased so dramatically? What was the investor's $25 million worth so many years later? And since the company isn't publicly traded, we can't know for sure, but we can infer the following using the numbers just stated. He paid $25 million for $4.2 million in earnings. This means he paid about six times earnings. And in 1987, the company's earnings were $82 million. So if we apply that six times earnings to that $82 million, we get a result of $488 million. So not only had he received all of this income, but now the value of the investment was $488 million versus $25. So what is this fantastic company? Perhaps a technology firm making billions, changing the world, or a future biotech on the verge of curing cancer? Nothing so esoteric. It's a simple candy company, a company known as See's Candy. And the investor is none other than, you guessed it, Warren Buffett. Of course, most of us don't have $25 million to purchase an entire company. However, our individual shares represent a pro rata ownership in the entire enterprise. If you are fortunate enough to go in with him on this investment, your experience would have been the same based upon your pro rata ownership. So, here's a few lessons from Uncle Warren. Number one, higher stock prices in the future may be related to, among other factors, higher earnings. Two, prudent investors create wealth by being patient, not by gambling or by indiscriminate trading. Three, buying complicated companies is not a necessary ingredient to accumulate great wealth. So try to stick with companies you understand. And four, stock picking on your own is subject to higher risk, so consider indexing or hiring a professional to actively manage your portfolio. Also, seeking professional advice before taking a risk with your financial future may be your wisest decision after all. There is little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. And the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we have entrusted our savings adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. So I've decided to add a new live event for my listeners to expressly address these issues. For example, everyone wants to know whether we have seen the end of the 10-year-old bull market. Some experts say yes, others say no. You know, if the experts are confused, what are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Come join me to find out. The markets are very volatile, and I'll show you ways to reduce the volatility. I'll show you how to handle it. What if the markets keep going down or stay down next year? I'll show you how to increase your income no matter what the markets do and reduce your taxes to boot. You see, I want to make sure you live your one best financial life and help you get the information you need to get it right. I'll show you some of the tools we use to get you on track and help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com to reserve your complimentary seat for Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. What does it take to create an iconic brand, and what family dynamics come into play once the brand is established and loved? Well, the story of the most iconic brand that has defined fashion for nearly a century is now told in a new book penned by the daughter of the great Aldo Gucci, the man who built Gucci into an icon. Patrizia Gucci joins me today from Geneva to talk about her new book, In the Name of Gucci, a Memoir. Hi, Patrizia. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's start a little bit at the beginning to give our listeners an idea of what life was like at the very beginning. Your grandfather, Guccio Gucci, started very humbly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the first Gucci family business was manufacturing straw hats in the early 1900s. And that didn't go too well after a while, unfortunately, and he then had to go to the Savoy Hotel to basically find a job because the family wasn't able to continue the way they used to be. And that's when he got inspired watching the very wealthy arrive with all their incredible trunks and luggage and see all their fineries. And he got an incredible insight as to how, you know, the wealthy lived and all the beautiful things that were made in those days. And he decided to bring that back to Florence and start something of that nature himself. But he needed to learn a little bit more about the world of leather and the art of making luggage and trunks, which he did. He went to a school. And then he began the business in Florence in 1921 and opened a little boutique there and started with trunks. And from then on, it went on to accessories and handbags and everything else, but done with a little workshop where he had artisans put them together and in the way that only a Florentine would know how to do.
Right. I was recently in Florence, and I did notice the amount of leather sellers there and the great manufacturers that are there, and I can tell that there's a culture there of fine leather making. That was something that was quite obvious. And by the way, I visited the Gucci Museum while I was there.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. It is a great museum. I really enjoyed when I visited it. Mm-hmm. There's so much that reminds you, of what Gucci's origins were all about. Definitely worth going to visit.
When Guccio Gucci opened his first store in 1921, your father, Aldo Gucci, was 14 years old. Tell us a little bit about Aldo Gucci, who really was the one who brought this brand into the modern era.
Well, he was an eager student of his father, and I believe the one who was most passionate about the company. So, as a young man, he basically wanted to know everything, how his father did what he did. And when he, grew into a young man, he decided, look, Daddy, we need to move on from Florence, and I believe we should move to Rome. And that's where he set up a shop in. And my grandfather was very supportive at that moment of his venture to go to Rome, even though always very conservative and thought, for him, Florence was good enough.
Yeah.
So they opened the first store in Rome in 1938. And then, of course, my father, there was no stopping him. And the next big venture was to go to New York and London. And in 1953, he came to New York and brought the phenomenon of the brand there because there was such an incredible recognition in Rome from Americans who would travel to Rome and after the war, and celebrities that brought back all the bags to America. So he felt that he would want to be in America because that's where the big business could definitely develop. And that's what he did, against his father's wishes.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to understand the kind of man that Aldo Gucci was. He was a very much of a forward thinker. He was, in a sense, married to the business in the best way of saying that, and really was always thinking about how well beyond wherever the business was currently. And also, he was very lucky in some cases as to where he chose his store locations. I know at the Via Tornabuoni and in Florence and other places right across the street from other places that turned out to be very lucky choices. How and why do you think he was able to get so much attention from the Italian movie stars and from Princess Grace? You have wonderful pictures in your book of her coming out of the store. What was special about the product back then?
Well, I don't think ever was down to luck how he chose his locations. I really did believe he had an incredible instinct. He would, you know, always walk everywhere and make sure he had a good understanding of the traffic and how the Gucci store could present itself, always imagining the name. As far as the clientele, I mean, you know, Rome, Gucci was number one, and there was nothing like it as far as leather goods and beautiful handbags, and it was one of those places where everybody, word of mouth, you know, spread like wildfire amongst the elite and celebrities and royalty, and obviously having them wear the bags created this incredible advertising throughout, you know, through the photographers would be out paparazzi outside the shop. So Grace Kelly was an incredible, you know, wonderful client, and Jackie Onassis, all sorts of Audrey Hepburn. They definitely gave Gucci a great, you know, advertising for the brand.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. She is the author and the heir of the Gucci name, and the book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. There's also a story in the book about the creation of Family Crest, that it was understood that in order to be taken seriously, the humble beginnings of the original Gucci family really had to be downplayed, and they created a complete new backstory. Tell us about that.
Yes, they reinvented their history. Coming from Florence, which is very much a city full of aristocracy and the most noble, a lot of nobility, you know, Gucci had to sort of set itself apart, not just as a handbag and luggage shop, but they also wanted to give it the history so that people would feel they were wearing something from generations and generations. And of course, it was an invention. But my grandfather got inspired to create the crest from the image of a bellboy, and he put that on the crest, and that's how they created this brand in that way.
However, they did change it to a backstory that included possible ties to medieval nobility, right?
Well, the Gucci name does go back in medieval times from the town of San Miniato, and we have traced it back. But as far as nobility and aristocracy, I'm not sure if that's anything close to the truth. But definitely the name Gucci and the family traces itself back to the 1500s.
Don't forget to find out more about Patricia Gucci and more about her book. And to hear this interview again, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Patricia, let's move forward now to the time when Aldo met your mother, Bruna. Bruna was hired by Aldo. And briefly take us through how they first really met and how their relationship developed.
Well, my mother went to work at Gucci when she was 18 in Rome and started as a shop girl and introduced to the manager by her fiancé, who knew him very well. And so it was a wonderful entrance into this world that she had never before seen, of luxury and glamour and something beyond her expectations. And she loved her job and was very happy. My father spotted her, of course. It was a small shop in those days. It wasn't a huge place like now. And she was a very beautiful woman and a young girl, actually, at those days. And you know, it was for the first year, it was all very proper, and you would just always give her special little acknowledgement. that he would give only to her, but it was nothing untoward. And then later on, he asked her to be his secretary. And there he showed his true intentions a little more and eventually got to a point where he decided to give her letters, because my mother was very modest and she absolutely made sure that she was, you know, never given any indication of interest. But he was a formidable person, much yeah. older and powerful, and it was her boss. And eventually his beautiful love letters won her over.
Those love letters are printed, a number of them are printed in the book, and he was really quite a formidable writer, and he was truly enamored and in love with her, but he was married at the time.
Yes, that was the unpleasant aspect of everything, because in those days also having an extramarital affair was considered a criminal act, not just a moral negative act. And therefore my mother, you know, was torn in being in this situation, and my father, though, you know, always reassured her that she was everything to him, and she had to have faith in the process, but that was easier said than done for my mother. She absolutely could not accept being in the circumstances. And so there was a battle of that for my mother all her life. She suffered a lot of anxiety due to it. It set a tone in her life that made her, you know, maybe not the person she would have become if she hadn't yeah. been in that position. Yeah.
Well, Aldo also had three sons, correct?
Yes, exactly. Around my mother's age.
Yeah, so that created quite a problem. And eventually, this affair came out to the family and created, you know, a lot of...
After my birth, it yeah. became knowledge.
Right.
When my mother had to have me in London and came back to Rome, and the word leaked out that my father had me mm-hmm. and that he had given me his name. Yeah.
I mean, the climate back then was such that if there was adultery, if there was a birth out of marriage, I mean, even Ingmar Bergman, who had an affair when she was married, I mean, the U.S. Senate actually banned her from public appearances. That's how conservative the country was back then. And in yeah. Italy, especially, mm-hmm. as you said, I mean, it was against the law. You could be imprisoned for being adultery.
And the Catholic Church.
The
was
Catholic
a huge,
Church, right.
part of the yeah. process, yes.
Yeah.
Very, very shunned.
But it was a huge hypocrisy when you think about it, because everybody was fooling around and doing
oh,
what they
absolutely.
Were doing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Italian men are known to be the biggest Casanovas.
Exactly.
And everyone had a mistress or so, but it's not that my mother was the first person that in his life out of his marriage, but definitely she was the one that he fell in love with on a level that he hadn't ever before.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. We will be back in a moment with the rest of this interview. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. You're listening to On the Money. I'm Steve Pomeranz. I'm here with Patricia Gucci. The book is In the Name of Gucci. It's a memoir, and we're speaking about the house of Gucci, the business, and of course, Patricia's life. Welcome back to our show here, Patricia.
Hello, nice to be here.
So you grew up in this environment, and you spent most of your life in England, is that right?
I was born in London, and I was raised there until I was 9 years old.
Okay. Tell us about your life after nine.
At nine, actually, I was a very happy little child going to English boarding school, and I didn't really know I had any other life until my mother one day decided to announce that I had three half-brothers and that my father had a wife and that we were moving to Rome, pretty much all in one conversation. So that was quite a revelation. I wasn't unhappy about having three half-brothers. I was not happy about leaving England.
How were you treated in London?
In England, I was in the country in those days. I mean, I loved it. I was English. I didn't speak Italian, so I was very much English. For me, it was my life. My friends were there, and everything I loved and cherished was in England.
When you moved
to Rome, it was a shock.
Yeah, so I'm sure it was. So were you accepted or rejected by the family?
Oh, absolutely accepted. I mean, you know, they embraced me, and my father was, after about a year that I moved to Rome, he organized an encounter with my brothers. And, you know, when we were all together in the room, it was all very cordial and kind. You know, one of them was even effusively affectionate. You know, he hugged me and called me his little sister. So at the beginning, I had no inclination at all that there would be any, you know, objection on their part, even though my mother was very cynical about it all.
My guest is Patricia Gucci. The name of the book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. And don't forget to hear this conversation again. Join us at stevepomerantz.com. Let's move forward here a little bit and talk about the business. Now, by the time you were 16 or 18, tell us the state of the Gucci business as you knew it.
Well, when I was 16, I was at boarding school in Switzerland, but I would occasionally fly to America on holidays. And my father started then introducing me to, you know, to social situations, like when he wasn't able to attend a function or a party or an event, he would have me represent him. I looked older than my age, and I had all the poise that him and the wherewithal, I think, that he felt I could do it. And therefore, that was my first realization of how incredibly important the name was in America. It was quite significant. And to have that name was also quite a, you know, it was an important thing to have,
sure.
But it was also quite overwhelming, you know, because people would look at you in a completely different way. And that's not how I was raised in Europe. But it was great. It was Gucci was in its heyday. There was nothing more exciting than to be around those exciting times. There's so much success and recognition.
So now you have been introduced to Gucci. The family has moved from England to Rome. You've been well accepted. As you got older, you started to represent the company, as you mentioned. So how is the business doing at that time? What year are we talking about?
Well, when I left school, I moved to New York to study acting. And one thing led to another. My father brought me even more into the company, you know, not just as occasional ambassador, but also, you know, to work full time. And in those days, this was in the early 80s, and it was still a brand of huge significance and influence. And, you know, people loved Gucci. Everybody wore Gucci. It was something, it was a uniform practically for every single person to have either a Gucci loafer or a Gucci bag. And it was, you know, an incredible company in those days, and it was a fun thing to be working, and there was nothing better, especially as it was a family company.
1953, Guccio Gucci dies, and your father wanted to change the business. He wanted to go public and distribute shares, but there was a lot of fighting about the future direction of the company. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I wouldn't say there was a huge problem. I think everybody knew what they wanted to do and where they would be. I mean, my uncle, Rodolfo, was a movie star, but it didn't work out in the long term. So he came back into the company, and his job was to pretty much manage the shop in Milano and you know, occasionally go to the factory in Florence. And my other uncle, Vasco, he was in charge of the Florentine factory. And my father was the man who just was the engine and just went everywhere and expanded and expanded and expanded and did what he had to do, marketed the company in every way that only he knew how, because he was the only one with the vision.
However, Paolo and some others conspired to take the business from your father. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
That came late. That was my father's son. You know, eventually Vasco died, my father's brother, and it was just my father and Rodolfo. So The sons, you know, my father gave them shares so that they would feel part of the company, and because Rodolfo was giving a lot of pressure to my father about their presence in the company and to make them feel just as important and not just employees. But Paolo was always a bit of a rebel, and he wanted to do things his way. He was headstrong. He tended to go against the grain and wanted to do things that were not part of the company's vision. And my father got very upset with him, and they were always fighting. And Paolo, you know, did a lot of damage in the family environment.
Yeah, so it was a lot of intrigue in the way that Paolo tried to, and actually eventually did, wrench control of the company away from your father.
Well, he had the opportunity to go to my cousin, who at that time, his father had died, and he inherited his 50%. So by going to my cousin, he made a deal, said, look, I can give you my shares, but you can buy my shares, and then, you know, my father becomes a minority. And that was how he took control of the company. Well, not Paolo took the control of the company, but that it was taken away from my father.
Mm-hmm. Was it during this time that your father was contacted by the U.S. Internal Revenue Service?
Well, Paolo, again, went to the U.S. Internal Revenue Service mm-hmm. and gave them information that my father had been evading taxes. And at that time, my father had a green card, was a resident. So they started a full force investigation, and my father ended up going to prison at 82.
Yeah, at 82. This must have been just an unbelievable, devastating blow for him.
It was the worst thing that could possibly happen to him, yes. It was one of the worst things, and that and the betrayal. I don't know which one could have been worse.
Well, thank you so much for sharing the Gucci story. The book is In the Name of Gucci, a memoir. Author is Patricia Gucci. And to hear this segment again and to find us on the web, go to stevepomerantz.com. Patricia, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
There is little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. And the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we have entrusted our savings add stress and uneasiness to our lives. So I've decided to add a new live event for my listeners to expressly address these issues. For example, everyone wants to know whether we have seen the end of the 10-year-old bull market. Some experts say yes, others say no. You know, if the experts are confused, what are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Come join me to find out. The markets are very volatile, and I'll show you ways to reduce the volatility. I'll show you how to handle it. What if the markets keep going down or stay down next year? I'll show you how to increase your income no matter what the markets do and reduce your taxes to boot. You see, I want to make sure you live your one best financial life and help you get the information you need to get it right. I'll show you some of the tools we use to get you on track and help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com to reserve your complimentary seat for Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What's going on with housing starts? We just saw a number last week that housing starts rose by 3.2%, but there's more story behind those headlines.
That's right. But the but is yes. Single-family home starts dropped. Starts means new construction.
Yeah. So that's not a good sign for the future of, well, the real estate.
Yeah, and keep in mind that these numbers are slightly distorted because of we had the fires in California, hurricanes. So it sounds a little worse than it really is, but there is some validity to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that suggests that there may be some pent-up demand, so you'll see higher numbers in a few months as those issues
get washed away.
Washed away, yeah. Unlike the houses in California and the hurricanes.
I know, I picked a bad word.
Bad choice of language right there. But it is also distorted because a lot of these starts were really in the apartment.
That's right. There's a lot more. I think it was up 20%, Steve, in apartments.
They're still building. Condos. I know in our area, they just love building these apartments.
Yep, yep.
And you wonder, will it ever end? You know, these things are so cyclical. And the lead time between the planning, you know, securing the property, the planning, the construction. And
it's several years.
It's years. Yeah. So the economy can be really good when they start and then really be bad when they end. And it creates all kinds of cyclical problems for these companies.
And you know what? Quite honestly, it may be more profitable for the builders to be doing that than single family homes. That might be another thing to think about.
That's true. Interesting. Well, we saw a report that luxury homes as well are showing some softness. I know the Toll Brothers said that they were showing less housing starts. I think the number was 9% cancellations and less housing starts. And those are luxury homes because their average price is around $900,000.
That's right.
Yeah. Versus the kind of the average price is about $300,000.
Correct.
So three times as much. Yep. So there is some softness in your industry. Now, what are you seeing in your particular area?
You know, it's kind of the same story. Our luxury market has softened. The balanced market, which would be in our particular market anywhere from, say, 5 to 7, that price range is balanced, meaning it's not a buyer's market, it's not a seller's market. Mm-hmm. It's starting to transition, where anything less than that is a buyer's market. So you're looking at under 400,000. Boy, we could use a lot of that inventory.
Yeah, so you need more sellers in that area, but the balanced in the 5 to 7, but you're saying it's starting to turn, you mean towards the buyer?
Towards the buyer, yes.
Towards the buyer. Yep. Yeah. So,
yep. So when the luxury market starts to come down in price, it usually starts from the top down.
Okay.
And
I didn't know that.
You'll see, it's just the way it works.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. Well, the other aspect of what's going on right now is that more homes are selling for less than their asking price than usual. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's actually it. It's about 62%. 2 out of 3 homes are selling less than asking. When you think about it, it's like, okay, that's no big deal because you price it at a certain price. You don't necessarily expect full price.
Right.
So what they watch is, you know, how many of these homes start to sell less than asking, which is also indicating or indicative of the houses being priced too high.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's talk about that because there is a negative consequence of pricing your home too high. So describe that for us.
Sure. So what happens, Steve, a lot of people put their home on the market based on what the neighbor put their home on the market and their home hasn't sold.
Yeah.
So you get all these sellers who think their houses are worth more because of what a neighbor is asking. They're not necessarily looking at what has sold.
Yeah.
Especially in a rising market.
Yeah.
It's easy to keep pushing the envelope.
Sure.
But in our market, for example, 20%, which is the absorption rate, 20% of the properties sell each month.
Okay.
So if you're going to be a seller and you want to sell your home, it needs to be within that 20%. It needs to have the condition of a 20% home. It has to be priced accordingly. So what we're starting to see is more and more price adjustments.
Now, the negative part of pricing your home too high is that if it stays on the market too long because of this bad pricing, then people look at it and it kind of gets
stale.
It gets stale.
Yeah, people say, well, what's wrong with it? Why hasn't it sold yet? Especially when you're dealing with buyers that are very savvy and educated.
Mm-hmm.
When a new one comes on the market and it's priced right, they pounce on it. They
jump
right
on it. There's a window.
There's that window.
You guys describe it as a window.
Correct. Really, in 2 weeks, I know exactly what's going on. In 30 days, if you haven't gotten an offer, if it's priced right in this market, it's probably not priced properly.
Wow. Interesting. Now, you were talking off air about a rule of thumb about the offers that you get.
Yeah. Well, so our rule of thumb is 8 showings and no offers, or, well, depending on the price point, 2 weeks and no showings, you need to consider a price adjustment.
That's all 2 weeks. That's not much.
Depending on the price point.
Yeah. But let's say you only had two showings.
So let's go 3 weeks. So 2 showings.
Yeah.
And it's been 3 weeks, especially when you just put it on the market, forget it.
Boy, that is a short window then.
It really is.
Has that window decreased over time? I mean, I haven't sold a house in a long time, so I don't remember.
No, what happens is you got to remember, anyone looking to buy a home who's been looking has been looking for the last 30, 60, 90 days. And once that most motivated buyer has horned in on an area and a new one comes on the market, they pounce on it. Mm. You'll get a rush of traffic. If it's not priced properly, those buyers are looking at it and watching it. Yeah, I'll wait.
No, they wait for the adjustment.
They sit there and wait for the adjustment.
And they're not going to sit there and go, well, I'll make a very low bid.
They
will
not.
People don't really want to do that.
No, buyers will only make offers on property that they feel are of good value or of value.
Also, there was this idea that the first offer is the best offer. We have about a minute left. Tell us about that.
Okay, so generally, yes, that is true. Because in the beginning, if it's priced right, those are your most motivated buyers. So they want the house, they're going to pay, assuming you're not way overpriced. So generally, as a rule of thumb, 9.5% of the time, it is your best offer, unless it's that ridiculous low ball. You'll know that low ball.
And you, as a professional, will go, that's not a real offer.
Correct.
Yeah, you'll know, you can smell.
You'll know, it walks like a duck.
Yeah, the thing is, if this offer is made and they haven't even seen the property, that would be one. No.
Real buyers make real offers.
Yeah.
They want to buy your house. They don't want to insult you.
Yeah.
And rarely do I get lowball offers.
Yeah. I know. I always thought, well, I'll price it at X. And if they want it, price it and give me a lowball offer, that's fine. I won't take it personally.
They won't make an offer unless it's priced right.
Wow. They don't do that.
That's the truth.
Okay. Well, a lot of good information there. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I'm very happy to welcome back Jonathan Clements, who is the founder and editor of Humble Dollar, which is a website. He's also the author of a fistful of personal finance books, including From Here to Financial Happiness and How to Think About Money. I'd love to have him on at every year end to discuss his money guide for the new year and whatever is percolating in his mind now for 2019. And you can find his money guide on humbledollar.com. That's humbledollar.com, and I highly recommend it. And I welcome him back. Jonathan, thanks for coming back on.
It's my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, you were telling me off air that in 2018, the beginning of 2018, or your forecast, which is always a scary thing for all of us, was quite correct. Tell us quickly about your 2018 forecast and what happened.
So back at the end of 2017, just after the new tax law had been passed, I wrote an article that was headlined Best Investment 2018. And it was a little bit out there for me, Steve. I don't normally make anything that looks like a prediction, especially a short-term prediction. But when I put together the fact that suddenly it was going to be much harder for people to have itemized deductions because of the cap on the mortgage interest deduction and the cap on the deduction on state and local and property taxes, coupled with the fact that bond yields were so low, coupled with the fact that stock market valuations were so rich, my advice for 2018 was pay down debt, even mortgage debt. That was potentially your best investment for 2018. And lo and behold, like the lucky gambler in Vegas, I got it right.
Yeah. So the idea would be if rates were going to go back up, they had some kind of a low plateau. What a great place to, you know, if you're paying 12% on your credit cards, there's a guaranteed 12% return that you can get. from paying down your credit cards. That would be where your savings would go. You know, I wonder if you can take that further to 2019. Now, I'm not suggesting in any way that this is going to be your 2019 prediction, but if you think it's possible where we are in the cycle that the economy starts to move towards recession, wouldn't it be also smart to continue to think about paying down debt so you're less vulnerable?
You're absolutely right, Steve. I mean, at this point, given that stock market valuations are looking somewhat more attractive, given the bond market yields have come up, the argument focusing solely on paying down debt is not nearly as strong. Nonetheless, if you're in a job where you think there's a chance of layoffs, getting your finances in shape ahead of a potential job loss makes a ton of sense. We know that unemployment tends to be a lagging indicator. That means that it takes a while for employers to start laying off people once the economy slows. So you might have a year and potentially somewhat more to get your finances in shape in case there is a recession. And what should you be doing? Well, getting rid of that credit card debt is obviously a smart move. If you have a 401k loan outstanding, you want to get that 401k loan paid off. If you lose your job and you don't immediately repay that loan, that loan becomes a taxable distribution, which means you're going to get hit with not only income taxes, but also tax penalties potentially. I would also think about setting up a home equity line of credit. That way, if you end up out of a job and you run out of your cash, one of the things that you can do is to tap into your home's value in order to cover the bills while you try to find another job.
Perfect. Yeah, so that's something to think ahead of time. Not that you will necessarily use it and don't get it and then start using it on frivolous stuff. It's there as a little kind of insurance policy, a little extra money should you find yourself in that situation. You know, Jonathan, you were talking about your 401k and getting your finances in shape. And the one idea that's come to me over the many years I've been practicing is this idea that if people are in jobs in industries that are cyclical, and there's a chance that they may lose their job during a down cycle, and at the same time, they have all their money in their 401k, they have it all in stocks because they've been told, hey, I'm in my 20s, I'm in my 30s, I should really, you know, have the vast majority of my money in stock, which theoretically is right if you're really not going to touch it. But if you do get laid off and you do need to, you know, go into that money and the economy is weak and the stock market's going to be weak, now you're pulling that money out at the worst possible time. And that sounds kind of dangerous to me. So I'd want to be careful as to what my mix would be based upon the cyclicality of my job. What do you think about that idea?
I think you're absolutely right, Steve. In theory, according to the academic theory, you know, if you're young and you have a job, that job is like earning interest from a bond. You're getting this steady paycheck week after week, month after month. And therefore, if you invest heavily in stocks, you're essentially diversifying your paycheck. The problem comes, as you suggest, Steve, is when your paycheck isn't like a bond-like stream of income. Instead, it fluctuates a lot because, say, you work on commission, because you're in a more cyclical industry where people tend to get laid off when the economy slows. Maybe you're in real estate sales and a recession might bring a slowdown in the housing market. If you're in that sort of situation, when you invest your 401k, you don't want to be 100% in stocks. Instead, you want to have some bonds in there because essentially you yourself is a stock. You have a lot of fluctuations in your value from one week to the next. And to compensate, to diversify that, what you want to do is have more of your 401k in bonds.
Okay. So I have to ask myself, am I a stock or a bond?
That's absolutely what you want to do. And if you're a Wall Street trader, and I bet quite a few of these guys, you would answer, I am a stock. And so I've met a lot of Wall Street traders who are smart enough to keep the bulk of their savings in treasury bills because they know the next time the economy turns down, they're going to get laid off and they want a pool of cash that they can turn to tide themselves over until they get rehired.
Not only that, if they were really smart and their compensation is based upon the vagaries of the market and speculating and all of that, they're not going to want to worry about their personal portfolio at the same time. That would cloud their judgment. So that's probably pretty wise there. So let me ask you this question. So physician, government employee, stock or bond?
Bond.
Okay, you're a physician. Why? Because pretty much steady income. It may go down, it may go up, but it's a steady eddy kind of job. Most healthcare, I guess, in many ways could be bonds. Real estate sales, I guess anything in sales, what would you say that is?
Yeah, if you're in real estate sales or any sort of job where you're on commission, you're much more like a stock.
Okay, Uber driver, you're a stock, I guess, right?
Yeah, you're more like a stock, though. People will continue to take cabs, you know, even if the economy slows down, they may not take them quite as much, but the hit to your income is probably going to be relatively modest. It's not as steady as being a funeral director. You know, people are going to keep dying.
But, if you want you steady know. Work, be a funeral director. What about like a pilot, you know, or a flight attendant or something?
The airline industry is somewhat cyclical. People tend to fly less, go on vacations less. There tends to be less business travel when the economy turns down. So you are a little bit stock-like. Still, I wouldn't be overly concerned. I wouldn't be as concerned as somebody who is a real estate agent or a Wall Street trader.
Yeah, so it's kind of common sense. You can figure out pretty easily whether you're a stock or bond. Okay, good. Good advice there. I want to move on to something else here, and this is particularly poignant these days when we have such a volatile market. I mean, the market, you know, pretty good in the middle of the year, and then it just, fourth quarter just started to fall apart, and now it's, you know, it's fluctuating 2%, 3% a day, and, you know, the S&P is negative as we record this and so on. So, you know, as an advisor, people say, well, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to sell? Are you going to protect me in this down market? And it always brings up this point that this sell decision is really very, very complicated. There was an article on your site from Adam Grossman. The site is humbledollar.com. You can find all kinds of great stuff, not only Jonathan's stuff, but others as well. And Adam is talking about the decisions that you have to make when you sell. So I want to start here. Step one, you have to predict what's going to happen and when, which would stop me right there.
So what we're talking about here is predicting the news.
Yeah.
And news, by definition, is not known. If it was already known, it wouldn't be news.
Right.
So in order to get into the market timing business, into this business of jumping in and out of the market, depending on what you think is going to happen, the first step is to say, I know what's going to happen in the future. Yeah. And that's pretty much a coin toss.
Okay, so that's number one. You've got to be pretty sure what's going to happen in the future, which I think is kind of a contradiction in terms. Then you have to predict that the impact of this event, whatever it may be, on the economy and the financial markets as well, because, you know, something political can happen. Like years ago, the market sold off very dramatically because the government was not going to be able to meet its obligations by year end. They were going to close the government, which they did for a very short period of time. But, you know, basically it turned into a non-event for the economy and the financial markets. Step three, take action quickly enough to benefit from what you would expect to happen. For example, if you thought a particular legislation would result in stock market decline, you need to sell your investments before other investors did the same thing and then drove the prices down ahead of you, which sounds like a lot of words, but basically it means that you've got to move when nobody else is moving. Because if the event was happening, they'd be doing what you plan to do before you. So you got to do it when nobody's thinking about it. And that's a contrarian position that's very untenable.
Or you have to be faster than all those high-frequency traders. You know, let's not tap dance around this.
Yeah.
By the time you hear this on CNBC, it is too late.
That's right. Exactly.
Because the high-frequency traders, the hedge funds, they've already got this information, and they, in split seconds, have bought and sold based on the latest news that is broken. If you are sitting at home watching CNBC, you see the news flash across your screen, it is already too late.
Yeah, it's already in the price, especially with the speed of transactions these days. Even Wall Street traders who are not trading the way you speak have trouble keeping up. We're going to stop at number four because I think number four is kind of the most important one. Let's say you sold and you sold correctly. You were right. You got out, market went down. Now you've got to reverse course. You've got to decide when to come back in. And I think that's the hardest decision because, you know, the market goes down 7%. Things have gotten kind of crushed. Do you go in then? Well, you know, it could go down another 7%. So, hey, is it over? Is this sell-off done? And I know that there were quite a number of people who, for one reason or another, got out before the 08 crash, but they never got back in, really, until they came to see me in 2015, 2016, and they really missed most of, you know, the return that was available to them. We're out of time, Jonathan. Last words for you?
The only thing I would mention is, in addition to all of this trading, if you do trade, if you get out of your stock market positions, remember there's often a tax cost.
Yeah.
So if you sell, you pay that big capital gains tax bill, not only do you need the market to come down, you need it to come down far enough to compensate for the tax bill that you paid, and then you have to have the courage to get back in.
That's right.
Getting that all correct is really, really tough.
Really, almost impossible. So really, the best activity most of the time is to do nothing, which I always say, unless you're a teenager, doing nothing actually is an activity. So teenagers are exempt from this law. But anyway, Jonathan Clements, thehumbledollar.com, and it's humbledollar.com. And if you have a question about what we've talked about, or you just want to kind of get online and tell us what you think, go to stevepomerantz.com and sign up for our weekly update, where you'll get all of our segments like Jonathan's here and so many others. We have them in segment form, in summary form, and in transcript form as well. That's stevepomerantz.com. There is little doubt right now that we're living in turbulent times. The daily drumbeat of news and opinion is enough to make your head spin. And the large ups and downs of stock markets into which we have entrusted our savings adds stress and uneasiness to our lives. So I've decided to add a new live event for my listeners to expressly address these issues. For example, everyone wants to know whether we have seen the end of the 10-year-old bull market. Some experts say yes, others say no. You know, if the experts are confused, what are you supposed to do under those circumstances? Come join me to find out. The markets are very volatile, and I'll show you ways to reduce the volatility. I'll show you how to handle it. What if the markets keep going down or stay down next year? I'll show you how to increase your income no matter what the markets do and reduce your taxes to boot. You see, I want to make sure you live your one best financial life and help you get the information you need to get it right. I'll show you some of the tools we use to get you on track and help you stay there. So go to stevepomerantz.com to reserve your complimentary seat for Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. That's Thursday, January 24th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel. For further info, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.